Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for May 14th, 2012. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast, and it, as promised, I have a discussion of how this hacker sees public policy, a more personal revelation of how I came into what I'm seeing increasingly as my second career. I also have a new hacker word of the week. Before I get started, I have one update and, I'll do a much quicker pass on the listener feedback due to the lateness of the hour at which I'm actually sitting down to record this. I had a chance to catch up with some former coworkers while I was in DC closer to work, so I'm just sitting down about an hour, hour and a half later than I'm usually used to doing this. Really, on the feedback front, I didn't get notes that were meant necessarily for sharing with everybody else other than perhaps Neil's suggestion that the root of the word crassy at heart of plutocracy and meritocracy and the like, speaking to strength or power, was kind of at odds with a true egalitarian and equality-based approach to governance. Other than that, the other feedback that I got, and I'm very grateful for, from Kevin was really meant as an encouragement to actually dig in quite a bit more into the discussion of meritocracy. So I will take those to heart and think about maybe doing a follow-up in some form or another, whether it's another entry in what's becoming much more of a series taking on a life of its own or in some other segment or framing. The other thing before I do get into the rest of the show very quickly is an update on the travel update from last time. It's just to note that the July trip to OSCON has unfortunately fallen through. So the other events that I'll be attending in the coming weeks and months that I did mention, most notably Freedom to Connect, that's coming up next Monday and Tuesday, Balticon the 25th through the 28th, and the week and a half that I'm going to be in London from the 7th to the 19th are still on. It's just that July trip. And I do also want to say, as a consequence of the fact that I am going to be volunteering and so much involved with Freedom to Connect next week, and then I will be at Balticon through Monday, the usual production night now, the new schedule, that the next 2 weeks are most likely going to be misses, but hopefully I will get a show out in that weekend between before I do take off for London. So do stay tuned to the website and the social networks for updates on the production schedule, as it's going to get a little uneven through early July until I get back from London and get back to the usual weekly routine. The hacker word of the week comes from The Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Fork. In the open source community, a fork is what occurs when two or more versions of a software package's source code are being developed in parallel, which once shared a common code base, and these multiple versions of the source code have irreconcilable differences between them. This should not be confused with a development branch, which may later be folded back into the original source code base. Nor should it be confused with what happens when a new distribution of Linux or some other distribution is created, because that largely assembles pieces that can and will be used in other distributions without conflict. Forking is uncommon. In fact, it is so uncommon that individual instances loom large in hacker folklore. Notable in this class were the Emacs Xemacs fork, the GCC EGCS fork, later healed by a merger, and the forks among the FreeBSD, NetBSD, and OpenBSD operating systems. I expect that it's the rare kid that grows up thinking they'll work in public policy. If I was able to ask my 10-year-old self whether I'd end up working at a think tank, even if I knew what such an organization was, I doubt I would clearly envision myself where I am now. That kid had just been exposed to programming computers and would have been far more likely to imagine doing something like creating games of some kind than writing, speaking, and acting to help nudge the regulations and laws around those games onto a more even footing, one that is a more deeply and correctly grounded in a considered understanding of the technologies in which those games are based and on their social and economic impacts. I very much enjoy my new career, but it has been the result of a very gradual process, one that I thought would be worth examining, as it is clearly shifting the kinds of experiences I have these days and the sorts of topics I now spend my time pondering and eventually discussing here. When the administrative or executive part of a government is working well, aligned with the norms of those that it governs, then its actions are more likely, I think, to go unnoticed, just part of the status quo. When those actions are disjointed or raise questions from the citizenry, I expect many still take this state of things for granted. That's just the way things are, the powers that be. I have had many conversations with friends and acquaintances over the years that inform my sense that public policy is largely ignored, with few narrow exceptions where it has a direct, unignorable impact. No doubt many folks, here in the US and elsewhere, have at least learned the basic underpinnings, either in a civics or a history curriculum in mandatory schooling. I know up until a handful of years ago, all of this was very much true of myself. Learning about how policy works in practice versus theory, either at its base or teasing out the more complex, higher-level interactions, was a process that took a good deal of time. Each step of the way, some new aspect was revealed through issues that grew increasingly important to me in my day-to-day experience. The trajectory of learning was in many ways similar actually to learning how to program in the first instance. As one gains mastery, it affects how you actually write code. With public policy, instead of looking back at more naive code and shuddering, I've had moments where I realized that my earlier views were unrealistic in some way, not taking into account enough factors that affected and inform how policy actions actually unfold and reveal themselves, what actually drives them. I'm far from the sort of mastery I currently possess with any number of technologies. My career shift was motivated in a large part because I felt that I was hitting limits on how much more I could learn there. This was a whole new frontier, if you will, to explore in an autodidactic fashion, the way that I've pretty much come up on everything that I find to be very meaningful in terms of thought and discussion. I feel very grateful for working at a growing organization, one that's going through, quite honestly, an amazing boom right now, that couples that with such a broad and deep body of experts and expertise. From the very first day, I had a sense I'd made the right choice because I was clearly reading a lot of the same material and could keep up to a certain degree. Much more acutely, I felt stretched, that I needed to really work that much harder in order to contribute in a conversation or a project. This stands in very clear contrast then to how I felt approaching opportunities that I had for discussion, for interaction, before adopting public policy as a profession, where it was easy, it was at my fingertips, at the tip of my brain to rattle off about some technology or another. It's delightful to be able to dive in and realize that you don't know quite a great deal and to have the privileges that I do, those opportunities for learning so much more. I think I actually have explained at least the very start of this transition onto a new path for me, in the form of first coming to understand how software licensing works, the kind of first instance that inspired much that was to follow. At first, I didn't really understand the underlying mechanism. I think that's quite common, actually, but had a curiosity on top of that that led me to reading and actually digging in quite a bit more. This was definitely an example of a narrow issue that affected me more deeply as a software professional, as somebody who had such a strong passion about the creation and use of software technologies. Early in my career as a developer, licensing was a big part of the cost inherent in doing so. Working at a growing software consultancy originally, embedded deeply in the very first web bubble, I felt a great deal of frustration too at the limitations of the market-dominant vendors, primarily Microsoft. My first experiences using Linux, by contrast, on a daily basis were wrapped in a rejection then of these closed and expensive tools for the creation and distribution of software. I didn't immediately leap to a stance of only using open source. In terms of an alternate server platform for running the web middleware that I was building at that time, my choice was Java, one that even after the language has been opened up much more recently, is still at the center of debates around patents and copyright in the form of now the current suit between Oracle, the latest owner of the Java intellectual property, and Google for the latter's alleged use of the language and APIs in the Android platform without a license. Even if the core platform was closed down then, and still isn't as clearly open as more modern alternatives that have been developed since, the community building tools and libraries on top of Java, at least on the server end, seemed then and still now, to me, to be fairly innovative as a consequence of at least some degree of openness. I credit this to a more open attitude by the original company housing the innovators responsible for Java, Sun, a stance of enabling the creation of others rather than trying to limit or control them, taking a more exclusive model. Just that simple utility value of more open systems, enabling of creation versus control, inspired a curiosity in me in how this was actually pulled off, how it was accomplished in actual day-to-day practice. It wasn't long before I was reading and learning a great deal more about copyright. The timing undoubtedly had a lot to do with how fascinating I found the subject. The DMCA was in the offing, just as the first truly popular digital media was starting to take off, really digital music, MP3. Debating whether DRM made sense and the clash of new and old business models around copyrightable works was fuel on the fire. A lot of great voices like Lessig and Doctorow were writing and speaking on the subject, making it a lot more accessible than I think it would have been otherwise. By this point, I was pretty well hooked and started to both expand my study to other subjects at the intersection of technology and public policy, like privacy and security, and to starting to take action in the form of local volunteering and online activism. I think the first time I was invited to speak about copyright pretty much sealed my fate. My first audience responded with the same sort of interest and curiosity that drove me up to that point. I was humbled and gratified by those early experiences of articulating what I had learned, helping others come to a more clear and relatable understanding of copyright and how it could impact and affect their daily lives in more general ways than the often narrow but drastic collision between quotidian reality and public policy. My feelings and personal views followed a parallel arc that was from, away, and now back to ultimately a radical stance on many of these issues, especially copyright. As a techie with some understanding of logical systems, my first reaction to understanding modern intellectual property was to deem it as fundamentally broken in the face of a post-digital, post-network reality. First instinct then was that what many a hacker would do with a stretch of code deemed flawed, that is, to scrap it altogether and to use the lessons learned to write new, better code. I'm thinking of a Chaos Computing Club Congress, I think it was 23, an exchange that took place at which when Lawrence Lessig was giving the keynote. John Perry Barlow, co-founder of the EFF, stood up and essentially made an impassioned case for dismantling copyright. Lessig responded with a great deal of respect that this isn't necessarily the most stable course for change, that sustainable revolutions find the least degree or part of a regime to overthrow to get the desired outcome. I was reminded of a comparison I read, I can't remember where, maybe in Lessig's own book, Code. One can argue that the reasons that the American and French revolutions had such different courses is that the former preserved more institutions, whereas the latter tried to scrap and reinvent everything all at once. As I've talked about in the context of the craft of software, there is usually far more value in what we often rush to label a legacy system. The dependencies upon such, whether in computer or legal code, are complex and difficult to untangle. Throwing away such a system, no matter how flawed, then often has a more far-reaching effect, as the consequences cascade out through those relatively unknown and little understood linkages. More cynically, I'm reminded of the not invented here syndrome that's so common in programming that in my experience most often arises from a lack of desire, motivation, or ability to read and really understand what some other coder has taken the time to build. My response to coming to realize how naive my early views were, even in some instances rather narrowly focused and informed by self-interest, was to try to delve deeper, to learn more, and to better understand existing institutions. My reading included more authors posing frameworks of thought and theories of action, including reading even more of Lessig, as well as adding more academics in this more broad vein, like Clay Shirky and Jonathan Zittrain. This desire to know more about existing structures in public policy also invited a curiosity about their history, how they actually came to be. In the last handful of years specifically, I've read much more on the historical dimension, authors like Nettinol, Johns, and Hyde, some of whom I've actually discussed in great depth on this very podcast. These days, I'm finding myself more often in this sort of Lessegian role, in response to the Barlow-esque, if you will, to trying to help a hacker coming to public policy for the first time, some other hacker, more quickly realize the lessons that I have over the years to inform a more broad reading and understanding of the subject. As much as I've come to the opposite end in some ways in terms of urging caution in the face of calls to abolish regulations on technology that ultimately reveal a profound disconnect, I still do understand that these political constructions are still, in many ways, quite broken. That continuity and the anemic outcomes that arise from calls for simple reform or just mere balancing are increasingly actually bringing me full circle, as I've discussed, asking whether demolition is perhaps warranted after all, but whether, with the benefit of all that study and experience, we can formulate more reasoned arguments around how and why we should do so. The other thought that comes up repeatedly that I question is that technology should justify a sort of exemption from engagement with public policy. The argument runs something like, those that are technically illiterate are not qualified to form regulation, establish economic policy, execute laws, act in the realm of public policy when it touches upon the very thing that they fail to understand. This view isn't going to stop those that have the power to affect policy from doing so, regardless of that very ignorance. Increasingly, I tend to think that technologists taking the first step to try to understand the world of policy is a better way to form a call to overcome technological illiteracy among policymakers. In the most simple instance, lawmakers, judges, and administrators rely on expert staff. Those that demonstrate a certain fluency in both worlds can pursue opportunities to advise informally or actually as part of that very staff. I don't think teasing out how public policy works is too different, really, from learning computer-related subjects. I don't think that it is beyond the realm of possibility that those that are motivated and interested in learning technology might also find similar parallel interest in the world of public policy. After all, it's really kind of, in many ways, like a complex technology system, like a computer operating system. It is larger and more sophisticated, harder to exactly define than other civic systems taken in isolation. For instance, it requires the interaction of several bodies, not just isolated branches of government like the judiciary, the legislative, or the executive. It's actually the interfaces between all of those and then many other actors beside. An operating system, in a similar way, is more than just a kernel or low-level hardware drivers alone. There's a lot of layers to it. There are a lot of components that have to interact to inform the overall user experience and to do the kinds of things that we have come accustomed to being able to do with computers. The bulk of the really interesting stuff is getting to some of the fundamental principles and working out how observed behavior arises from their complex interaction. I'm not saying all technology advocates need to move to their respective policy capitals, like inside the Beltway here in DC or to Brussels in the EU. For every agitator, though, championing and defending technology from ill-informed policies trying to grasp and enclose it, I think there should be perhaps at least one counterpart finding some way to bridge between the two as well, so we're acting on multiple fronts, so that once the provocateurs get the attention of the policymakers, they make a conviction out of their arguments, we have a more sustainable system for steering them towards better day-to-day decision making, not just the large course corrections like we've seen with the rising tide recently of online action. These are just some of my personal experiences and thoughts on the subject of public policy from a more hackish perspective. Undoubtedly, many of you have questions, have experiences of your own of where these two meet. They might agree, they might disagree. We've had some interesting conversations to date as I've kind of glanced off this subject previously. Hopefully bringing this much more to the fore will invite, as always, much broader and deeper discussion with all of you. As always, you're welcome to send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, where I'll be happy to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this week. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show, as I mentioned in the outro, will probably come out in 3 weeks on June 4th, and hopefully will be some of the event audio that I'm going to get a chance to record, some of it on new topics. So we'll see. I'm very excited to see how this comes out at Balticon. That's Memorial Day weekend, as I've mentioned repeatedly, the 25th through the 28th. So until I put out that first post-Balticon episode, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits, and you share your changes under the same license.